The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Anger and bitterness over the president's phone call to a grieving widow of a fallen soldier.
I guess he knew what he was getting into. How insensitive can you be?
It stuns me that a member of Congress would have listened in on that conversation.
Former presidents are weighing in on the political climate.
Bigotry seems emboldened.
We are rejecting a politics of division. We are rejecting a politics of fear.
And later, amid all the noise, Oprah Winfrey is writing about spirituality in this day and age.
I think it means to understand that the essence of who you are comes from a mystery greater than you can define.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Rakoff in the CBS News Washington Bureau. White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly made a surprise appearance in the White House briefing room Thursday afternoon to address the controversy stirred by the president about contacts of presidents with families of deceased soldiers. He told reporters that he was stunned to find out that Florida Congresswoman Frederica Wilson had listened to the phone call Mr. Trump made to the widow of Army Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, Myesha Johnson, as she was making her way to the airport to greet the remains of her late husband. Here's a portion of General Kelly's comments.
And he said to me, "What do I say?" I said to him, "Sir, there's nothing you can do to lighten the burden on these families. But let me tell you what I tell him." He was doing exactly what he wanted to do when he was killed. He knew what he was getting into by joining that 1%. He knew what the possibilities were because we're at war. And when he died, in the four cases we're talking about, Niger, my son's case in Afghanistan, when he died, he was surrounded by the best men on this earth, his friends. That's what the president tried to say to four families the other day. I was stunned when I came to work yesterday morning and brokenhearted at what I saw a member of Congress doing. A member of Congress who listened in on a phone call from the President of the United States to a young wife, and in his way tried to express that opinion. He's a brave man, a fallen hero. He knew what he was getting himself into because he enlisted. There's no reason to enlist. He enlisted. And he was where he wanted to be, exactly where he wanted to be, with exactly the people he wanted to be with when his life was taken. That was the message. That was the message that was transmitted.
White House Chief of Staff John Kelly on Thursday. So, how did we get to this point? CBS News correspondent Nancy Cordes has a timeline.
The four U.S. soldiers were ambushed during a routine patrol just over 2 weeks ago by 50 ISIS-connected fighters.
Our thoughts and prayers are with.
But for 12 days, the president himself said nothing about the deaths. No tweets, no statements, until he was asked about his silence at a Rose Garden press conference on Monday.
I'm going to be calling them. I want a little time to pass. I'm going to be calling them.
But then he made this explosive claim about his predecessors.
The traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls.
The comment drew instant fury from top Obama officials. One said, "Stop the damn lying." Another called him a deranged animal. But the president wouldn't back down, offering up his own chief of staff as proof. Kelly's son, Second Lieutenant Robert Kelly, was killed in Afghanistan in 2010.
You could ask General Kelly, did he get a call from Obama? You could ask other people. I don't know what Obama's policy was. I write letters and I also call.
On Tuesday, President Trump did call LaDavid Johnson's widow as she was riding to Miami Airport to retrieve her husband's body. Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson happened to be in the car.
He never said the word hero. He said to the wife, "Well, I guess he knew what he was getting into." How insensitive can you be?
She said his tone made Johnson's widow cry. President Trump said Wilson was making it up.
Didn't say what that congresswoman said. Didn't say it at all. She knows it.
But the fallen soldier's mother told the Washington Post he did say it. And Wilson said five other people were in the car, too.
I don't have time to go back and forth with the president. I have work to do. He has work to do, too. So he needs to do it like I'm doing mine.
That's CBS's Nancy Cordes reporting. Many inside and outside of Washington are lamenting the harsh political tone these days, and that includes a couple of former presidents. We have more on that from CBS News correspondent Margaret Brennan.
Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication.
The 43rd president made no mention of the 45th, but his focus was clear.
We've seen our discourse degraded by casual cruelty. At times, it can seem like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than the forces binding us together.
He suggested that an America First mindset is distorting our democracy.
We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America.
There was no specific reference to President Trump's mantra.
That was fake news.
But President Bush pointedly called on journalists to uphold their integrity for the sake of the republic.
Our democracy needs a media that is transparent, accurate, and fair.
A similar call to arms was made by another senior Republican earlier this week, Senator John McCain.
For the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems.
Former President Barack Obama also spoke out.
The world counts on America having its act together.
Appearing at a Democratic rally in New Jersey, he urged young voters to fight back.
We are rejecting a politics of division. We are rejecting a politics of fear. That we are embracing a politics that says everybody counts.
President Bush said he believes the American spirit will ultimately prevail.
The American spirit does not say we shall manage or we shall make the best of it. It says we shall overcome. And that is exactly what we're going to do.
Joining us now is CBS News political director Steve Chigueras. And Steve, General Kelly's statement Thursday was extraordinary in the personal nature of his words.
Yeah, he put his credibility on the line. There are a lot of people that are criticizing President Trump for what he has been saying about these calls to military families and some accusing him of politicizing it. Kelly went out there to defend the president and say, look, I helped him. I helped prep him for these calls. And what he did was the right thing. It might not have been conveyed totally, or might not have been received the right way.
Steve, is this a case of Kelly just being a good soldier for the president?
Being a good soldier, but also I think probably a little bit upset as to how politicized this has become. I think he laments the fact that this has become as political as it has. Part of that has to do with his boss. Part of that has to do with the reaction to it. And I think he was trying to tamp some of that down.
Still to come, ISIS is routed in Raqqa, but at a horrible cost.
They will somehow have to find a way to rebuild this shattered city where there is hardly a building that is unscathed.
Our CBS's Holly Williams is on the ground in Raqqa. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. The governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello, paid a visit to Washington Thursday. He met with President Trump, cabinet officials, and members of Congress regarding ongoing recovery efforts on the hurricane-devastated island territory. As CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy reports, it was another chance for the president to claim credits.
He gives his team a 10 out of 10.
It's really been incredible to watch how quickly things are coming together.
Sitting alongside the governor of Puerto Rico, President Trump said of Hurricane Maria,
I think it was worse than Katrina.
Governor Ricardo Rossello gave Mr. Trump credit for responding immediately.
The president has answered all of our petitions, and what this is still ongoing.
Close to 80% of the island still has no electricity, and cell phone service remains spotty.
With your support, Mr. President, with your team's support, we will be able to come out of this.
Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, the White House.
The Senate Armed Services Committee held a hearing this week to talk about cybersecurity issues in the wake of the 2016 election. The committee chairman was none too happy that its top invited witness was a no-show. Arizona Senator John McCain blasted the administration for denying White House cyber coordinator Rob Joyce to appear before the panel, highlighting what McCain calls the disarray about cybersecurity in the government.
There needs to be a voice in the cabinet that focuses on cyber. Obviously, there's supposedly one there, but he is not appearing before this committee.
McCain was also upset with defense officials who said that cybersecurity was more of a homeland security issue.
I am in fundamental disagreement with you about the requirements of the Department of Defense to defend the fundamental of this nation, which is a free and fair election, which we all know the Russians tried to affect the outcome.
It was a huge defeat for ISIS this week as the militant group abandoned its one-time self-declared caliphate of Raqqa in northern Syria. CBS's Holly Williams was one of the first and few reporters to enter the city.
This place used to be an ordinary traffic circle, but then ISIS turned into a place where they carried out public executions. They posted the evidence of those horrific killings on the internet. Now, Al Naim Circle was retaken by these U.S.-backed Syrian forces. We witnessed them on the streets of Raqqa celebrating. They were in a victorious mood after a four-month-long battle. It is a bizarre feeling to be here because during the three-plus years that ISIS was in control of Raqqa, if I had somehow made it into ISIS territory, I would almost certainly have been taken captive and very likely killed. Now, there are thought to be ISIS fighters still lurking and buildings and in tunnels here in Raqqa, and it could take months until the city is finally cleared of explosives that were laid by ISIS. Then they will somehow have to find a way to rebuild this shattered city, where there is hardly a building that is unscathed. Nearly all of the residents from Raqqa, perhaps all of them, have now left the city, and many are in refugee camps. It is a terrible irony that in order to retake Raqqa from ISIS, they've had to destroy it.
CBS's Holly Williams reporting from Raqqa in northern Syria. It started out as a normal day for workers at a granite warehouse just outside of Baltimore, Maryland, Thursday, but that changed in an instant after one of the employees pulled a gun and began to shoot. This is Harford County Sheriff Jeffrey Gaylor.
Five victims that were shot here at the business behind us this morning. And again, three are deceased. We hold that number and we pray that number doesn't get any higher.
Two employees remain in the hospital. Authorities say the suspect, 37-year-old Radhi Prince, then drove to Wilmington, Delaware, about a 45-minute drive away, and shot an acquaintance at a used car lot.
He gave us the name, who was the same victim, same suspect from Maryland, same description of a vehicle that just shot him.
That's Wilmington Police Chief Robert Tracy, who says Prince was eventually caught Thursday evening after a 911 tip about a man matching his description in a nearby neighborhood. As for a motive,
I don't know what goes through his mind and why he was doing it. What he did the first time to shoot five people, the rationale to go out and shoot five people like he did, kill three of them, and then come all the way here to shoot this individual.
Prince was arraigned on Friday in Delaware. It's expected he'll be returned to Maryland to face charges there. It's been nearly 3 weeks since a man opened fire on an outdoor concert in Las Vegas, killing nearly 60 people and injuring hundreds of others. Now, we're hearing for the first time from the security guard who was Stephen Paddock's first victim that night. He spoke with TV host Ellen DeGeneres. More from CBS's Jamie Yukas.
As I was walking down, I heard rapid fire.
A routine door check turned to terror for Jesus Campos. It happened moments after he arrived on the 32nd floor when he noticed something unusual about a stairwell door.
There was a metal bracket holding the door in place.
When you saw that, did you think, that's weird, why would somebody put brackets on a door?
Yeah, that's just out of the ordinary.
Campos took a different route back to the hallway and then radioed a maintenance engineer to check the bracketed door. Moments later, Stephen Paddock opened fire.
I felt a burning sensation. I went to go lift my pant leg up and I saw the blood. That's when I called it in on my radio that shots have been fired. And I was gonna say that I was hit, but I got all over my cell phone just to clear that radio traffic for they can coordinate the rest of the call.
Campos took cover and then saw maintenance worker Stephen Shuck get off the elevator.
Take cover. Yelled at me, and within milliseconds, if he didn't say that, I would have got hit.
We also learned that a female guest came out a hotel room door, and Campos immediately told her to take cover. Many believe Campos diverted the gunman's attention before Paddock killed 58 people.
Campos believes a slamming door alerted the shooter to his whereabouts. He did not clarify any of the details of the changing timeline of the shooting, including whether Mandalay Bay did in fact call police that night.
That's CBS's Jamie Yucas reporting. California is home to some of the country's most powerful women in politics, including its first female House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. But behind the state's progressive political image lies an ugly epidemic of sexual harassment. CBS News correspondent Bianca Golodriga reports.
As a lobbyist in Sacramento, Pamela Lopez says she's been a victim of sexual harassment. The most disturbing incident happened about 2 years ago.
He rushed up behind me, rushed me into the restroom, locked the door behind him, exposed himself.
Lopez, along with more than 140 other women, issued a letter blasting what they call dehumanizing behavior. Men have groped and touched us without our consent, made inappropriate comments about our bodies and our abilities. Insults and sexual innuendo, frequently disguised as jokes, have undermined our professional positions and capabilities.
You touching my body in a way that is not welcomed is harassment.
Democratic State Assemblywoman Christina Garcia says a lobbyist grabbed her inappropriately 5 years ago, and that's one of the reasons she signed the letter. Garcia says the issue of sexual harassment is not only nonpartisan, it shouldn't even be a women's issue.
It's not our responsibility. It's not the victim's responsibility. It's how do those with power, how do they help fix this problem?
That's CBS's Bianca Golodriga reporting. Still to come, Oprah's got a new book coming out, and she's talking about spirituality.
I think it means to understand that the essence of who you are comes from a mystery greater than you can define.
That's next on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. The Senate has passed a budget for fiscal year 2018 and sent it to the House for its approval, but many are saying that the budget bill was simply a vehicle to help Republicans in the Senate get tax reform through the body. CBS's Nancy Cordes explains.
The tax reform bill is still being crafted, but it could not have gone anywhere without this crucial vote. So Senate Republicans needed to try to find the kind of unity that has been eluding them lately, and they did. The budget they passed makes room for a tax reform plan that would add about $1.5 trillion to the federal deficit over 10 years. So that's the price tag they're going to be aiming for. And now that they've passed this budget, Senate rules will allow Republicans to skirt any Democratic filibusters when it comes to tax reform. They'll be able to try to pass their tax plan with a simple majority, 51 votes instead of the usual 60. Could help to ease the tensions that have been bubbling up recently between President Trump and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell after a series of failed votes on health care, even though adding to the deficit, as this tax plan will do, is typically something that Republicans oppose. Now, this budget is going to have to be reconciled with a version that passed the House last month. Democrats argue that the tax plan that is still being crafted will mean big breaks for corporations and the wealthy, and not much for the middle class.
At CBS's Nancy Cordes, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, meanwhile, talked tax reform on CBS this morning with hosts Charlie Rose, Nora O'Donnell, and Gail King.
Our plans are in place, the train's in the tracks, and we're rolling down the track. And the whole point of getting tax reform done, increase people's paychecks, higher wages, faster economic growth, which gets us a healthier economy and more jobs. And so that's what we're excited about, and we're really, really pleased the Senate did their heavy lifting on the first stage of this yesterday.
Are you going to make the case that this is not a tax cut for the wealthy?
Well, that's why we're introducing the fourth bracket, so that high-income earners do not see a big rate cut and that those resources go to the middle class. This is about the people, about half of which in this country are living paycheck to paycheck, and giving them a break on their taxes, giving them some tax relief, and closing loopholes and carve-outs, which disproportionately benefit the very high-income people, the very well-connected businesses. By plugging those loopholes and lowering rates for everybody, you make it fair and simpler for everybody. And we also think it's important for our businesses. Bring their money back from overseas. make their tax rates competitive with the rest of the world, so that you have an incentive to stay in America and make things in America.
The president has said that this income tax plan will not benefit his family. He says, believe me, it will not. How can we believe him, though, Mr. Speaker? Well, do you think that's fair, then?
I think what he's going at is, and the president's the one who has been very insistent that we reintroduce what we call the fourth bracket, meaning we don't lower taxes for high-income individuals. That, I think, is what he's talking about. So that all that revenue goes to the middle-class tax cut. That's what I think the president's talking about.
So then could you give us the details on what those four tax brackets will be?
Well, right now, yeah, I can give you three of the four details. So okay. it's the 12% bracket, which means people who are currently in the 10% bracket, that goes to zero. People who are in the 15% bracket, that goes down to 12. Then we'd have a 25% bracket and a 35% bracket. And the fourth bracket that the president and others are talking about that we're going to do, we're working on those numbers. Now that we have a budget resolution from the Senate, we want to make sure that we get a final budget resolution between the House and the Senate. Once we get that budget resolution, that tells us how our numbers will work. Then we'll introduce the bill, which will have that fourth bracket designed to make sure that we don't have a big drop in income tax rates for high-income people. Their bracket's 39.6 right now.
Right.
And then we have a middle-class tax cut.
I was going to go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say one of the things that the president's plan does is would eliminate what's called the federal property tax deduction for state and local taxes. That would, in New Jersey, for instance, people who live in New Jersey, that would add about $3,500 for every family. That's a huge, when you're talking about people living paycheck to paycheck.
That's right. So that's this is going to be designed to lower tax rates for people in the middle, not people in the high end. So let's just take this in perspective. You double the standard deduction, that's that many more people who don't even have to itemize their deduction. You lower people's tax rates, that means less of their income is being taxed in the first place. You increase the per-child tax credit. You get rid of the marriage tax penalty. All of those things benefit everybody in the middle class. And on the point you just mentioned, Nora, this is what the Ways and Means Committee is looking at, is how do we make sure that middle-income taxpayers in New Jersey, New York, Wisconsin, wherever, make sure that they actually benefit in the net on this thing, that they benefit. So the goal here is look at it in its totality, and what we want to make sure that even people in these states that you mentioned that have discrete issues, they too benefit.
And that's House Speaker Paul Ryan appearing on CBS This Morning. Oprah Winfrey's new book, The Wisdom of Sundays, is out, a collection of moments from her series Super Soul Sunday, where she has in-depth spiritual conversations with the likes of Tony Robbins and Shonda Rhimes. She recently spoke about the book with our Steve Dorsey.
What do you think that means to be spiritual?
I think it means to understand that the essence of who you are comes from a mystery greater than you can define, and that you are seeking to be in touch with that essence in every waking moment of your life, that you know that your life is bigger than what your physical presence actually offers. So it's not about religion. Oftentimes on Super Soul Sunday, I talk about the difference between, I've actually asked practically every guest, what's the difference between religion and spirituality? And everybody, in one form or another, points to the dogma, the ritual, the order that religion can bring to your life. But having a spiritual experience is about connecting to the essence of that, which is you and is greater than you.
Oprah, you've also been working on another project with a new role at 60 Minutes, including your second report Sunday on solitary confinement, right?
It's actually on Pelican Bay, which is, or certainly had been since 1989, the greatest maximum security prison devoted to security housing units exclusively, meaning everybody who went there was put in what they call the SHU, which is another word, actually, for solitary confinement, even though they don't like to call it that. And it's about how all of these prisoners ended up in the SHU, not because of what they did on the outside, but because they were validated as being gang members on the inside. So you'd be thrown into the SHU and stay there, like thrown in, key thrown away. I talked to a guy who'd been there 24 years. Can you imagine 24 years in solitary confinement? 24 years you never saw a blade of grass. 24 years you never saw a tree. And the issue is that when you lock up people for years in solitary confinement, at least we're asking the question, do you drive them mad? And is that madness what you want coming back into your communities.
Oprah Winfrey with our Steve Dorsey. You can see Oprah's segment on 60 Minutes at 7 p.m. Eastern on CBS or anytime at cbsnews.com. Still to come.
The stock market dropped by 22% in one session. That is as if the Dow dropped 5,000 points or more right now.
Reflecting on the big crash of 87, 30 years on. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. The holiday shopping season is about on us, and a new report from creditcards.com is out on high-interest retail credit cards. It says the average annual percentage rate on those cards is around 25%. Retailers are offering some rewards to try to lure new card holders. Matt Schultz is senior analyst for creditcards.com. He joins us via Skype. Matt, these are some pretty high numbers we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's something. These retail credit card interest rates are really sky high. The average one that we saw was 24.99%, and we saw one that even topped 30%, and then several others that were right around there.
All right, Matt, let's talk about the brands with the highest rates.
Yeah, we saw that the brand source credit card, the APR is 30.49, which is the highest we've seen. And then there are a few others that were at 29.99, which were Big Lots, Piercing Pagoda, and Zales.
2 points to this question, Matt. Who needs to be wary of this deal? And is there anybody for whom a high interest rate credit card with rewards like these makes sense?
If you can't pay your bill on these retail cards at the end of the month in full, then the math just doesn't work. They're just not a very good deal because, to put it simply, it doesn't make sense to pay 25% to get a 15% discount. That said, if you are somebody who knows that you can pay your bill off at the end of the month, then it can be good to get that extra discount. And the other people that this could potentially work for is somebody who is either new to credit or is just rebuilding their credit and may not have any other options. These cards would be accessible to them. However, it's just incredibly important that in that situation, you understand that you really need to pay your bill off in full as quickly as possible because those interest rates are so high.
Matt Schultz from creditcards.com is with us talking about high interest rate credit cards offering rewards in an attempt to bring in new customers. So, as always here, it seems like a case of buyer beware, right?
You definitely need to understand what you're getting into with these cards and not allow yourself to be pressured into a decision or to be coerced by a big discount. You really need to know that you can pay that bill off at the end of the month.
And lastly, a personal opinion question. Is this in your mind a ripoff or is it simply business?
I wish that these rates were low, absolutely. And I wish that they weren't necessarily offered in that pressure-packed situation at the checkout counter. But the truth is that this is just kind of business.
That's creditcards.com senior analyst Matt Schultz speaking to us via Skype. Well, the stock market is at an all-time high with the Dow up over 23,000 points this week, but can it last? CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger talks about the markets on CBS This Morning with Gail King and Jeff Glor, and also about this week's anniversary of the big crash of 1987.
I think the first thing is that the economy is growing, and the global economy is growing, and that may have a bigger factor this year because the rest of the world has caught up to the U.S. We also know that corporate profits are doing quite well. They've done quite well for the last 6 months or so, and that's been helpful, and we're in a low interest rate environment. You put those three things together, you get a surging market, and it's a continuation of this strong bull market. It is now the second longest bull market on record.
Well, the president's taking credit for the surge, can he?
Well, I think partially. I mean, let's think about this. We've got a bull market. It started back in March of 2009. So the first 92 months of the bull market, that occurred under President Obama. the most recent 11 months under President Trump. Now, the reality is when he was first elected, people thought the market's going to go up. We're going to get infrastructure, we're going to get spending, we're going to get tax reform, we're going to get regulatory reform. Of those three, we've gotten a little bit of regulatory reform. That's it. So I still think the fundamentals are what's driving the market right now, not so much what the Trump administration is doing, although they are saying they will do something.
That said, how worried are you about how long this can last?
I'm always worried. The 30th anniversary of the crash of 1987, and I hate to admit it, but I was a young pup trader that month, and it was scary. That day, the stock market dropped by 22% in one session. That is as if the Dow dropped 5,000 points or more right now. That was caused by a confluence of various things, but reality is those things are not present now. They could always happen. It's good to be defensive. Don't take on too much risk.
That's CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. And now to the Japanese phenomenon of karoshi, where people are literally working themselves to death. CBS's Lucy Kraft has more from Tokyo.
Years after losing his son, Itsuo Sekigawa is still in shock, grief-stricken and angry. Straight out of college in 2009, his son Satoshi proudly joined a prestigious manufacturer. But within a year, he was dead. Investigators said the stress of working extreme hours drove him to take his own life. The young engineer fell victim to the Japanese phenomenon of karoshi, or death from overwork. An early day for him was going home at 9 p.m., his father says. If work wasn't finished, he'd stay until midnight. Young women are just as vulnerable. This month, state broadcaster NHK revealed one of its reporters, 31-year-old Miwa Sato, had died from heart failure after working near 14-hour days. It took 4 years for NHK to announce Sato's death. Her parents accused the network of a cover-up.
The reality is that in Japan, workers are working ridiculous hours. I think that's hard to deny.
American labor activist Louis Carlett says such sacrifice is seen as a virtue here.
There's a strong cultural norm that you have to devote everything to the company and you're a corporate warrior. And I think that's what really pushes people over the edge.
Karoshi hits everyone from doctors and truck drivers to computer programmers and construction workers in Japan. Grieving father Sekigawa says while Americans work overtime to get ahead, Japanese work extreme overtime because they are forced to. Last year, just under 2,000 Japanese committed suicide for reasons linked to their jobs, a number that has remained stubbornly high for two decades. Families of karoshi victims say the government's proposal to cap overtime at 100 hours a month and exempt many professions won't stop people from working themselves to death. There is no job worth a human life, said Sekigawa. But if our politicians pass laws that really hurt companies, they'd lose elections. So I'm afraid the situation is insoluble. Lucy Kraft, CBS News, Tokyo.
Still to come.
You know, looking at the earth and, you know, with no political borders and realizing that we're all in this together.
Existential thoughts from an astronaut. Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Bill Raycock. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Check out CBS News Radio podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Anthony Mason every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our Week in Review magazine show. It's all available from CBSNewsRadio.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Raycock. Living life aboard the International Space Station is certainly a thrill, but is a challenging feat as well. Astronaut Scott Kelly knows this very well. He lived aboard the ISS for a year and has written a book about it, Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. Our Steve Dorsey spoke with him.
First, Scott, I want to ask what it takes to be an American astronaut these days. I've heard it's quite a bit different than it was back in the early days of manned spaceflight.
Yeah, so in the early days, it was more about being the test pilot of the spacecraft as we built brand new vehicles and flew them into space, whether it was in the Mercury program or even Apollo. And of course, the early days of the space shuttle were a lot like that. But now, flying to the International Space Station on board a Russian Soyuz, you're more of the, you know, an engineer, a scientist, and all the other jobs you have to do in space is, you know, primarily our focus. So it's a lot less test pilot and more a lot of other activities.
Of course, your year in space helps give us some clues into what the journey to Mars could be like. How do you think that's important in choosing astronauts for the future?
I think NASA does a very good job at vetting the people that we select for these kind of missions. And our international partners do a very good job of it, too. But certainly having someone that's, you know, has the, I think the psychological stamina to be isolated for a really long time is going to be really important to the success of any long-term space mission.
You talk a bit about privacy in your book. What's it like living in those close quarters on the space station with folks from around the world?
You know, the space station on one hand is pretty big, you know, but also you can't leave. And even though we have some crew quarters, that's your private area, each person has a little room they sleep in, which is kind of the size of a phone booth. You do, you know, spend most of your time in close proximity to your crewmates for long periods of time. So, yeah, there is a loss of privacy. But at the same time, you know, I like all the people that I was up there with. And it was a great experience sharing the time and space with them.
Scott, now to something a little different in your book. You talk about being aboard the space station when your sister-in-law, then Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, was shot in Tucson back in 2011. Describe the challenge of coping with that and how you were trying to sort through what your twin brother Mark, also an astronaut, was going through on Earth.
Yeah, so that, you know, tragedy happened when I was on my previous long-duration flight, which was 159 days. And I was about halfway through on January 8th, 2011, when Gabby was shot and six other people killed in Tucson, Arizona. And I, you know, I tried my best to be there for my brother Mark and support him and my other family that was also, you know, struck by this tragedy, which is hard when you're on the space station and you can't come home. After a few days, you know, I realized that the stuff I could control was the space station, my job, my, you know, taking care of my crewmates, and I pretty much had to, you know, compartmentalize and put the, you know, this tragedy that happened on Earth to my family as much as I could.
Well, you've obviously got a new perspective on life on Earth. How has your time in space reframed that?
Most astronauts that fly in space, especially people that are up there for long periods of time and you get to look at the Earth, you really appreciate the beauty of the planet, the fragility of our atmosphere. You can see pollution, you can see deforestation. So I think people that fly in space generally become more environmentally conscious of our planet. And there's also what some people refer to as this orbital perspective you have on, you know, humanity in general, and how when you look at Earth from space, you realize that all 7.5 billion people are down on the planet. You and your crewmates are not. And most of the news we hear from Earth is bad news. And, you know, looking at the Earth and, you know, with no political borders and realizing that we're all in this together makes you more, I think, empathetic for the human condition, the people, the planet.
That's CBS's Steve Dorsey speaking with astronaut Scott Kelly. And from the cold of space to the cold of winter, climatologists are out with their winter forecast for the United States.
Did you like last winter?
The temperature and precipitation outlooks are somewhat reminiscent of the forecasts we issued last year.
And the one before that. But from Mike Halpert, Deputy Director, Climate Prediction Center.
It would be quite surprising to see a third very warm winter in a row.
He does say winter drought is possible in the Great Plains and parts of the South untouched by the hurricanes this year. Jim Taylor, CBS News.
Now, a preview of this week's episode of 48 Hours. We're joined by correspondent Peter Van Sant, who brings us a story this week called Red Notice for Murder. Peter, this is an amazing story, and it's got some international intrigue to it. Tell us about it.
Well, this involves a woman who lives in Brooklyn, New York, Nadia Ford. Her mother's in Russia, and they communicate every day and have done so for years. And back in October 2014, suddenly her mother was not answering phone calls. The daughter gets very concerned, checks the phone log because she controlled her mother's cell phone over in Russia, and discovers that a neighbor was the last person to call her mother. She senses something's wrong, and Nadia gets on a plane, flies to Russia, ends up in this town called Krasnodar, where we go in our 48 hours investigation. And she spends 6 months investigating her mother's murder, six long months. She comes across some highway camera photos that show the next door neighbor, a woman named Victoria Nazarova, driving a car with what appears to be her mother sitting next to her. She convinces police to bring Victoria in for a lie detector test. She fails it. But before Russian authorities can arrest her, Victoria flees and ends up in Brooklyn, of all places. And so there is this worldwide manhunt for this woman, now suspected of murder, that ends up in Brooklyn, New York. They use Facebook. People are really stupid. She was posting on Facebook some pictures of herself, and she was wearing reflector sunglasses that a private investigator here looked at, and it gave everything he needed. In the reflection was a apartment building where she lived, and also a unique car that she was inside that had stitching that this private detective goes to the Long Island Railroad parking lot, finds a car with similar stitching. Long story short, they eventually narrow it down, and they find Victoria Nazarova, this murder suspect in Brooklyn.
Red Notice for Murder will be broadcast on 48 Hours. You can see it on Saturday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, also online at cbsnews.com. Correspondent Peter Van Sant, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for the Weekend Roundup. Thank you for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your thoughts, story ideas, whatever. Weekend Roundup at cbsnews.com. The show is always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and now Spotify. Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is our technical supervisor. Ashley Armstrong, the production assistant in New York. Alyssa Roshaw is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Bill Rakoff, CBS News.